Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the former Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. Currently, he's the Executive Director of Public Lands Media. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently, Protecting the Wild. So first off, thank you for all your work in the world. Second, thank you for being on this program so often. I love talking to you. And the third is, I guess that's two. Thank you for your work in the world and thank you for being on the program. Okay. So anyway, so today we hear a lot about how because Indians in North America burned some parts of some forests, therefore it's these days that means that we need to bring in some chainsaws and cut down parts of these forests. We need to manage these forests. And it gets pretty well. I'll just take it from there. So how just talk about this.
Sure. There's been a steady stream of news articles and posts and so forth in the media arguing that Indian burning of the landscape kept the vegetation healthy, because they argue not just burning forests but other kinds of landscapes, grasslands, etc., and that indicates that we need, that is people in general, humans, need to manipulate the landscape to keep it healthy. And there are a lot of problems for me in that kind of assertion. And the first is there are a fair number of studies that demonstrate that Indian burning, while it did occur, was mostly localized in effect, in its influence. And that makes sense for a lot of reasons. One, it's not like you got a lot of time on your hand to go out and burn the whole state of California down, for example, or whatever, by setting fires. And it's always risky, too. If you're going to set fires, it could burn your village up. So the emphasis was, burning in and near your village or common travel places, and that part of the landscape was burned more frequently than probably would have occurred without humans being there. But in a lot of the rest of the landscapes, the evidence suggests that, you know, there's plenty of ignition sources like lightning and other ways for fires to get started, and that there really wasn't that much increase in the burned area or the area burned as a result of human influences. And the other thing that's kind of interesting is it's not really unique to any particular area or race. There's evidence that back in Europe that 90,000 years ago, people were setting fires to try to attract game animals to the burnt areas, because a lot of times after the burn, say grassland, greens up, it's very nutritious, and people observed that and said, okay, well, if we just, rather than just letting happenstance create the fires in the green areas, we can set some and bring in some mastodons or whatever they were hunting back then. So anyway, the idea of burning to attract wildlife or to facilitate certain species that are sort of flourish under a fire regime is not unique. But we have, I hasten to add, we have a lot of evidence that's evolutionary in nature that this burning was not as extensive as people want to suggest. For example, the usual line is that the burning was frequent every couple of years to maybe 10-year intervals. And if you go out to something like sagebrush, which is a lower elevation, major ecosystem across the West in the Great Basin and other places, sagebrush doesn't have any adaptations to fire. And if you have a lot of fires frequently, it doesn't come back. But we know that fires could not have been that frequent because we have lots of sagebrush across the West. And not only do we have lots of sagebrush, we have lots of species that evolved to depend on sagebrush, like sage grouse, sage sparrows, sage thrashers, pygmy rabbits, and a host of other species that are primarily or only found in sagebrush ecosystems. So that suggests that burning wasn't as extensive as suggested for that reason. The other reason we can question that assertion is that a lot of forest types, higher elevation forests, for example, west slope of the Cascades, Douglas fir, had fire rotations that were often centuries long, you know, 300, 400, 500 years between major fires. And so how would you get a 500-year-old tree if it was being burned all the time, you know, even to get established? So so we know that that influence was more localized in certain ecosystems, primarily like valley bottoms, grasslands, and that sort of thing. And so what's problem is it's been exploited.
Before we get to the exploitation, I want to mention another thing that I'm sorry if I missed this when you were saying it, but another reason that the landscape would not have been burned everywhere is that, you know, if you're burning it to increase habitat for deer or something, it would be really silly to do that 200 miles from where you live. Because so the point is, it will be, you want to have it near enough to the village that you can walk there, but not so near that you burn down your village. So there's going to be, again, it's not going to be the entire landscape.
Well, you know, actually, that's another point I sometimes make, is that strategically speaking, you want the burned area to be unique in the landscape. In other words, if it were everywhere, why would a buffalo or an elk or anything else graze near your village if they could do it 100 miles away? So you want to make it something that is unique enough in the landscape that it would have that attractive value.
So, I guess.
So, yeah.
Go ahead.
What I wanted to continue is that part of this, why I don't have any problem, to tell you the truth, with some prescribed burning going on, but I have a problem with it when it's extrapolated to, you know, lots of areas that are inappropriate, like sagebrush or chaparral and other places that cannot tolerate frequent burning. But the other part of it is the idea, it's a philosophical thing, the sort of this fundamental idea that the planet can't survive without humans manipulating it. And every one of the plant communities in North America, for example, existed prior to whenever any paleo Indians showed up from Asia. And so to argue that, oh, the landscape requires human intervention, especially using North or South America, is kind of absurd. I don't know of a single plant community, there might be individual plants, but major plant community that you could say has depended upon human ignitions to sustain itself. And so, and it's part of this larger debate that's going on right now about the role of humans in the planet. There's this segment of academics and others who argue that humans are essential to maintaining, quote, a healthy planet. And I would say that mindset, putting humans as central for one thing, is basically the problem that creates all this environmental degradation, in that the idea that humans are somehow special and not just a part of the planetary ecosystem that should have equal status with everything else out there is part of the problem. And it's this idea that we're somehow special. And I think that that's a dangerous notion to perpetuate.
Okay, before we go any further, I'm going to do sort of a meta comment here, which is that the fact that you just said that humans are not particularly special among all species and that we should, you know, how did you say it? Can you say it again? Because I think it's really important.
That we shouldn't make the idea I was trying to get across is that making humans the focus and the center of the universe, so to speak, is a dangerous notion, because that is what has contributed in the long run to a lot of our environmental problems.
So if any of the listeners ever wonder why I interview you 6 times a year, that's the answer right there. Because I think that is so incredibly important. And that manifests through all of our discussions. You know, when we're talking about what has happened to Arctic char, like we did one time, or when we're talking about any of the other subject, wolverines, any of the subjects we're talking about, I mean, it's all informed by that incredibly central notion that you just put forward. So I wanted to stop there, highlight that, and thank you for it. And now we can go on with the regularly scheduled interview. So you know where I first heard, or I don't need to ask you, where I first heard anybody say that humans need to manage forests was back in the 1980s, and it had happened before, obviously, but I was too young to recognize it. Anyway, in the 1980s, the timber industry would constantly say, these forests are decadent. These forests need management. How do you have a healthy forest without chainsaws? And you remember that, right?
Oh, sure. Yes.
And even though I was in my 20s and not necessarily very savvy, it didn't take a lot of cognitive ability to think, if forests need chainsaws to survive, how did they survive before the invention of chainsaws?
Exactly.
And so can you go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to say, I had a similar sort of aha moment, or whatever you want to say. I was in, I originally started college as a forestry student. And when I was in college, that same idea that forests were decadent and overmature and all these other negative adjectives were used to describe them, and that and the general consensus was logging them would make them more productive and healthier, and it just didn't jive with me. But at the time, you know, when I'm 19 years old or whatever, I didn't know enough about ecology to refute it in any kind of informed scientific way, but there was just something in my gut that said this is not right. and so of course, as we've discussed in many times on these interviews before, part of what drives all this is how you define things, and the timber industry has been very good about defining what constitutes a healthy forest. And the measurements they use are rapid growth of trees. And why rapid growth is important to the timber industry is because they want to cut them down and have some more grow. But that is not necessarily, from an ecological point of view, the best measurement of what constitutes a healthy forest. And it's not just in forestry. We see this in all sorts of stuff. We've seen it in human social situations too. For example, I always tell this story. There was a period of time about 100 years ago where it was sort of a fad, or whatever you might want to say, that the size of a person's skull was thought to indicate their intelligence. And so there were a lot of scientists that were going around measuring people's skulls, and they were accurately measuring them, and they found that men had bigger skulls than women. So, of course, the evidence suggested that men were more intelligent than women. But the problem was that was the wrong, the assumption that skull size indicated intelligence was completely wrong. as we've learned since then. But there's that's an example of how the assumption that underlies the work influences the conclusion. And the other point I like to make is that these scientists weren't trying to, you know, fix the data or anything like that. They accurately did measure skull size. It was just the underlying assumptions were wrong. And that's a lot of what goes on in science. The whole idea that a healthy forest is one that doesn't have many dead trees, or that old trees are slower going, therefore it's not as good for the forest. All that kind of assumptions were accepted without being challenged. And that was the problem with the idea that we got to cut down the trees to make them, to make the forest healthy.
So you don't have to, but would you like to give sort of a little history of some of the justifications that have been used across whatever industries you want for why it is necessary for humans to manage their surroundings, to manage forests, grasslands, whatever. We know that you know, the timber industry has said it's because it makes a healthier forest, or because there's a forest epidemic and the trees are dying, so they need to be killed now. There's all sorts of, do you want to go through justifications for forest and or the larger scale? And if you don't, that's fine. I'll go a different direction.
Well, I can just give a few examples. And I'll preface it by saying that usually there is some financial incentive, or sometimes a power incentive, for these kinds of assertions. So let's look at wildlife management. And again, I'm sort of like you. I don't like using those terms, but for the time being, I'll just have to use them. But the idea that the way to have a healthy deer population, for example, is to get rid of predators like wolves. But there's an incentive there. Fish and game departments earn their money by selling licenses, hunting licenses. And if there's more elk and deer in the population that can be shot by hunters, as opposed to being eaten by wolves, then the idea is, well, we want to eliminate wolf predation, or at least a lot of it, so that we have more elk and deer and we can sell more tags. And we sell more tags, that keeps our jobs and our bureaucracy going. Using wildlife as an example, again, most of the biologists that I know that study predators do not agree with that kind of scenario or management, but they're within a larger bureaucracy that will override their concerns. And you see the same thing in range management. Again, I hate using the word that way, but range management of grasslands for livestock production. For years, we were told, sort of like forests, that you had decadent grasses out there that needed to be grazed to be healthy. And I can give you lots of reasons why decadent grasses are not decadent. Nevertheless, that was the presumed assumption. And so therefore, the best way to make a grassland healthy was to graze it by domestic livestock. Now, that's a pretty happy coincidence for the ranchers and the people that promote livestock, of course. And it ignores the fact, I'll just use grassland as an example, there are plenty of places where livestock or any other large grazing animal never get to. The sides of cliffs, you can go in many canyons around the West and find very productive and healthy grasslands there that are growing just fine without any kind of large herbivore, even deer and so forth, grazing upon them. Or another good area that people might be familiar with, because it's easy, even if you're an urban person, look at the right-of-ways along highways. Some of them, of course, are mowed by machines, but a lot of them aren't. And there's very nice grasslands growing there on the highway side of the fence that the cattle and other herbivores never reach. Now, I hasten to say that in almost all grasslands, the majority of grazing, so to speak, or herbivory actually comes from insects. But we're so focused on the large animals that we ignore that fact too. So in other words, even if there wasn't a cow out there, it's not like the grasses aren't having some sort of herbivory on them, but they do just fine without the cows.
I read somewhere recently, and I could be off by a factor of, but I read somewhere that 90% or 80% of herbivory is insects.
That's right. In Yellowstone, for example, which has probably the most intact assemblage of large wild herbivores we have left in the temperate zone, you have bison, you have bighorn sheep, you have pronghorn antelope, elk, deer, and some smaller, herbivores like ground squirrels, et cetera. All those animals, all those mammals that are out there are outcompeted by grasshoppers. Three times as much of the grasslands is grazed by grasshoppers than by all those large ungulates and smaller rodents put together. And so exactly what you said. And then if you put in what you could call sort of herbivory in a sense that it also leads to decomposition, you have fungi and other things that are are decomposing or eating those grasses as well, even in the absence of large herbivores.
I'm going to throw out one piece of trivia and then we can move on. The trivia is I read this article maybe 6 months ago about how they did a study. I don't remember who, but somebody did a study that shows that, you know, how it's really important for wolves to move large herbivores around so that they don't overgraze in one area. Somebody did a study that showed that spiders basically perform that same function for grasshoppers.
Right.
It's a micro macro thing that to keep the grasshoppers from congregating, the arthropod predators will show up and push them around just like they do at the larger scale. I thought that was just the coolest thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're on to something. And one of the things that I've seen over and over again is how these processes are repeated at all levels in our ecosystems, you know, from the smallest living things and even non-living in some cases, but how there's similar processes going on at all these different layers and levels in an ecosystem. And so we often get drawn into, you know, the whole human bias thing is a good example of what I was just talking about, ungulates in Yellowstone. The thing we see is the bison and the elk, and we assume they must be the major grazers on all the grasslands there because, you know, we have this bias towards what's large and obvious. And that applies to the human condition, so to speak. We see humans all over the globe, and we assume that we're the most important things out there. And in fact, just like the ungulates in Yellowstone, the most important thing may be insects.
So let's talk about. I think we've both been pretty clear that, you know, you have some people living in place for 5,000 years and they burn a small area every few years or something. That's, you know, we could have a discussion about whether that helps the environment or whether the environment affords it. But that's actually not what I'm interested in right now. What I'm really interested in this moment is how I would like for you to make the relationship clear between. Yeah, Indians burned a place 2 miles from their village, and the notion that, well, I'm going to back up and tell a story, which is 1995 or 96. I was doing, my first conference ever, and I gave a talk, and then afterwards there was an environmental philosopher gave a talk who just made me furious. And no, he gave a talk first and I was furious and I rebutted him when I came up. And one of the things that he had said was that, yes, so Indians manage the landscape and, you know, we all have problems with that word manage, you and I. But therefore, and he really said, Therefore, it's okay for Boise Cascade to do come in and do their timber operations. And and so can you, if you want to bring in Emma Morris, that's fine. If you want to bring in any of those other people and show their arguments, because that's some stuff that I think is incredibly dangerous.
Well, you're exactly right. And I hear that justification all the time. I'll tell my own story along the same lines. Years ago, I attended some public hearing about designating critical habitat for grizzly bears in Montana. And so all these people were testifying, and they'd get up and say, I represent Louisiana Pacific, and they'd always start their statement and saying, I'm all for protecting grizzly bears. And then they'd go, but we don't think you should do it here. And part of the reason is because we're actually helping grizzly bears, because see, when we log the forest, we create more huckleberries, and bears like huckleberries. So therefore, you know, if you were to designate critical habitat and not allow logging, you'd actually be hurting the bears. And the problem with that philosophy or that thought process is several. One, the biggest limiting factor on grizzly bears in Montana is getting shot, and they get shot along roads. And they're not starving because of a lack of huckleberries, because huckleberries are created by wildfire, and we have plenty of that source of huckleberry regeneration. We don't need loggers to go out there and cut the trees. And so that was, you know, sort of an insight to how these things can get perverted to justify larger, more destructive kinds of activities. And I think, you know, it's good to be skeptical whenever you hear those things, and understand that there's a reason why people are presenting that, because they have a vested financial interest in that kind of suggestion. I can't say that everything I've ever heard like that would be wrong. I, you know, but a lot of times, because I just don't know enough about it to have a judgment.
Another thing I want to bring in is, I'm guessing you either already understood this, or this made a difference to you, but one of the most important things I ever read was David Ehrenfeld's line about nature is not only more complex than we think, it's more complex than we're capable of thinking. And I like to combine that with another thing that he said that was so important to my, you know, 28, 29-year-old self, which was, just because we're capable of committing minor miracles, we think that means that we can commit major miracles. And what he means by that is, we can make a computer, we can, you know, it's miraculous in a sense that you and I are talking from, what, 400 miles away? And
right. And
because we can commit those minor miracles, we think we can commit major miracles, like, and I think one of the examples he gives is manage a forest.
Right. No, I, you know, I, exactly my feelings. It's to me, it's an amazing arrogance to suggest that I know, or anybody knows, what creates a healthy forest, because there's so much that we're ignoring. Just like using the example of the fact that trees store lots of carbon, even burnt trees store carbon. Then, you know, a long time ago, it was thought, well, you still hear it, that if the forest is burning up, it's releasing carbon. It does, but it doesn't release nearly as much as the logging does. And we're just not capable of pulling all these things together into a comprehensive overview, because partly there's a whole lot out there that we are not even aware exists. And, you know, and it always kind of surprises me. It's like, I'll get in conversations with these advocates of manipulation, whatever area it is. And they always say, well, you know, we didn't know better. Like, let's say killing wolves is a good example. Back 100 years ago, we killed all the wolves we could because we thought it was good for the elk herd. Now we know better. Well, you know, why do you think that? Okay, and I'm glad we've learned. I'm a big advocate of science and learning from it. But I always have to say in the back of my mind, well, what am I missing? What more is there that's out there that I don't know? And yet you have all these people who say, well, you know, we made these mistakes before, but we're not going to do that anymore. Well, I guarantee you 20, 30, 50 years from now, there people are going to look back and say all those things that people thought they were doing that was good, turns out it wasn't so good in the end. And not that it was done on purpose a lot of times, just we didn't know better.
So I would like for you, if you don't mind, I would like for you to make clear that what we're talking about is not just a few people. I would like for you to try to make clear how common this notion is that nature needs to be managed. And I mean, I can say for myself that when I used to do a lot of talks, I got that response from a lot of people who would come up and say, but Charles Mann said that there weren't many passenger pigeons in the East and that we need to, he actually has a line about that all of America was a giant a created landscape. And they said that anything, that they did whatever they needed and we therefore can do basically anything goes. That's pretty much a direct quote. And there's that. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the irony is that I see, and this has been increasing in the last few years, but that both the political right, who generally represent exploitive industries, and the political left, who generally espouse social justice issues. So they're not coming at it for the same reasons. But the end result of their advocacy is often the same, which is in using Charles Mann's 1491 book as an example, his assertion that humans, that is Native Americans, were so pervasive and had such a large effect that nothing in North America was truly a result of nature that without human influence. And I just think that's, one, is an absurd statement, and we have other reasons why I can tell you why I think it's absurd, but just think about it today. Even today, with as many people as we have in the United States, and we have, you know, modern weapons and technology and so forth, but there still are large areas of the country that have a minimum amount of human influence, and granted, things like climate change are, you know, planetary in influence. But for example, if you were to compare how much influence humans have on some place like the Arctic Wildlife Refuge in Alaska and compare that to the LA Basin, well, the LA Basin has a lot of human influence and not a lot of natural nature left. In other words, non-human affected landscapes. But the Arctic Wildlife Refuge is still largely affected by natural processes, or what wilderness advocates called self-willed land. And if we have that kind of landscape today, it's just absurd to suggest that at much lower populations and with much more limited technology, that Indian people were able to have a major influence on a lot of landscape. I don't deny that there was local influences, just like with the fire issue. There were a lot of places for a host of reasons that seldom saw people. For example, intertribal warfare was a factor in keeping areas more or less free of humans, because everybody was afraid to go there because they'd run into the other guys that were going to try to kill them. When Lewis and Clark left the Mandan villages on the Missouri River and followed up the Missouri River through Montana, they didn't find any major Indian villages along the Missouri River. And some have suggested that was because it was sort of a no man's land, sort of like the demilitarized zone in Korea, where tribal people didn't enter except occasionally to go hunting because of risk of being attacked by other tribal people. And then there's geographical things. I've been writing a lot about Yellowstone lately, and there's this absurd notion that Yellowstone was greatly influenced by tribal people there. And if you spend any time in Yellowstone area, it's high snow covered place that's cold 8 or 9 months of the year. And any person with sense would not try to spend the year there. They would move to lower elevations, which is what the wildlife did, especially in the days before there were fences or any other reason to block their migrations. And humans were the same way. They followed the game down to where it was warmer, less snow, and so forth. And so the ability to influence Yellowstone was pretty limited by the geography and the climatic conditions. And so there's lots of places like that that had very limited human use. And that is one reason why I think things like national parks and wilderness areas are so important, because it's a philosophical thing. There's a lot of attacks going on right now about parks and wilderness that, it's a cultural paradigm, and there's no real place like wilderness. And I feel like dropping those people off in the middle of the Arctic Wildlife Refuge and see what they think about that statement. But nevertheless, the idea that that there's no such place where land is self-willed, and it's not that it's, quote, pristine. That's a straw man that a lot of these folks use to argue against wilderness and parks. Say, oh, well, you know, an Indian camped here once, and therefore it's not pristine. That's not the issue. It's how much influence do people have on any particular landscape? And a lot of the landscape was had limited impacts because populations were low and technology was limited. And the more you, when you have those limitations, it makes a big difference. For example, Jared Diamond, he's written Guns, Germs, and Steel. He wrote another book called The World Before Yesterday. And it's all about tribal people and studies of them and, how they were organized and so forth. But one of the interesting comments that he made is that in all these tribal people around the world that have been studied, human violence was the number one source of mortality. People were fighting each other all the time and killing each other. And, when you don't have a lot of population to begin with, that's a big limitation. And it was such that that intertribal warfare and fighting is very much like with wolf packs, which are also social hunters. And, if you're a wolf from another pack and you enter into my territory, my pack tries to kill you. And that's one of the ways we protect our food source, is by setting out territories, marking them, and defending them. And, tribal people were very similar. So
Sec. I was interviewing, I don't remember who, but a wolf expert who told me that wolves are the single largest cause of mortality for wolves.
Yes, exactly. It's true. Yes. And that's just like how humans were in the past. And, in these low technology groups, tribal groups, in fact, there are various I'm mostly focused on Indians of the plains, but it was a common thing for tribes back, back in the 1800s or probably earlier, but we only have written references to it from that period of time. But it was very common to raid other tribal groups to just collect women. And they would try to get women to have babies, but raise them as their tribal members. If you were a Crow tribe and you were losing so many men in battle and warfare, so you would go out and try to capture, say, Sioux women or some other tribal women and have them become part of your tribe, partly to compensate for the loss in mortality of warriors. It was really unusual. You and I, if we were in a tribal system, we probably wouldn't be alive at this point in our life. People didn't live that long, partly because of all the violence that was common. And there were other things, disease and so forth too, starvation. But apparently, according to Jared Diamond and other researchers, human violence is the number one cause of mortality in tribal people, and it's not surprising, because we see this in chimpanzees and all, lions. I mean, there's so many social hunting groups that have similar systems, so I should not be surprised to hear that.
So I want to go back to areas being managed or not managed by humans and mention a couple things. One of them is that I read a biography of Tecumseh maybe 20 years ago or 15 years ago. And one of the things that he made a big point of was that Kentucky was fairly low human population at that time. So I'd be around 17, the late 18th, early 19th century, was fairly low population around that time prior to major settlement by whites, in great measure because all the people around it recognized the importance of refuges for wildlife. And so you could go in there and hunt, but the population was kept low so that there would be basically a large wilderness or park from which their game populations could expand.
Well, you know, I've heard the same thing about Kentucky in that area. And the other term for it was the dark and bloody ground because of the intertribal warfare. And so I guess you could say what was the cause of that refuge, which did exist, was some people suggest it was just the same thing as I was talking about with the Missouri River in Montana, that that was the battleground between the Shawnee and the Cherokee and sort of the edges of their territories. And they both would go hunting there, like you suggest, but they wouldn't settle there because they'd be too vulnerable to being attacked. And the interesting thing, too, about Kentucky, just as an aside, you know, there was elk and bison and other things like that in the East. And Kentucky has a lot of salt licks, and salt is something that the animals crave. And so that was one of the focuses for hunting, was to hang out by salt licks and wait for the bison or the elk herds to come in and see how many you could kill. So anyway.
So the next thing I want to come back to is another thing that's not often mentioned in this is that when they talk about there is no such thing as two other mistakes that they make when they say, you know, so-called pristine, is one of them is that, yes, humans affect every land base, but then so do wolves. And you're not going to say that because one wolf walked across it 3,000 years ago, or there was a wolf community there 3,000 years ago. It's, my point is, everybody affects the land base. That's not the question. The question is whether that land base ends up stronger because or not because of this action, and more resilient, etc. And then the other thing I want to bring up is that I've actually talked to a lot of indigenous people around the world about their own stories for this. And so many of them have told me that, yes, we lived here, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about Maoris or it doesn't matter. Yes, we lived here, but there were places we didn't go. There were places that were, to use the word that one person used, taboo. It's like, so right. They had de facto wilderness areas. They didn't put a village on every piece of ground. And I'm sorry to keep hammering this, but the arguments that the other side make are gaining so much traction, and it really, I think, is very harmful.
Exactly. I think it's an attack on the whole concept of our conservation strategies. That's exactly the point that I've made to myself, is that for various reasons, you know, superstitions or because it was a dangerous place to go, or it was just not conducive to exploitation, like I was talking about the, you know, Yellowstone in the wintertime. There were lots of places that received little use. And yeah, you know, one of the arguments I get from the people that are opposed to parks and wilderness is, well, you know, Indian people had no word for wilderness. So they didn't have a word. Of course, they didn't have a word for wilderness. They had another word. That's the place we don't go to, or whatever. And but every culture around the world, there, and I know of no exceptions, had places that were off limits for a variety of religious reasons. As I said, because they were difficult to exploit or dangerous to enter or whatever. There were always places that got little or no resource extraction, and were largely controlled by natural forces. And so, in a sense, what our society has done is in North America and other places is we've taken that idea, and places like Yellowstone are the equivalent of these special places that all people have had around the world. And we just happen to have a slightly different name for it. And we have a legal system that provides a way to delineate it and protect it with certain regulations and rules. But there were, you know, societies all around the world had regulations and rules about what you could eat and what you could kill and when you could do this or that. And it's really no different. It's just a different, every society had a different way of doing it, but they all had some sort of system like that, and we're no different.
I'll also point out that when they say that Indians had no word for wilderness, therefore we shouldn't have wildernesses today, they don't acknowledge that indigenous people also did not have words for cell phones, automobiles, or Wi-Fi, and therefore we should get rid of them.
Right, yeah.
Anyway, back to I'm sorry that I've sort of taken us all over the map today, but we have about 5 or 6 minutes left, and can you really address, just let's cut through all the anecdotes and everything, and talk about nature. Okay, when I talk to old school environmentalists, by those by whom I mean people who are still more about caring for wild nature and wild beings as opposed to continuing civilization, etc., when we hear the word management, well, I was talking with a friend of mine the other day who works to protect prairie dogs, who she says, when I hear the word management, I always in my head substitute killing. And and I was just yesterday talking with an old school environmentalist friend of mine, and we were talking about Orville Camp, who is an eco-forester type. And I met Orville Camp 30 years ago, and it doesn't really matter what our opinion, 20 years ago, it doesn't really matter what our opinions are in general, but one of the things I said to him was, I have some respect for him. And I said to him, I have a lot of respect for him, actually. And when I said to him, if all of the foresters in the world were put on trial by a jury of trees, you would be one of probably three or four who would not be hanged. And he took that as the tremendous compliment that I meant. So mm-hmm. My point is that most, quote, forestry is actually deforestation. Most,
right,
quote, range management is actually range destruction. Most, mm-hmm. When I hear the word forest management, I know what they're going to do is they're going to kill the forest. And right. So I know I was asking you to say all that, but I just said it. So take that wherever you want.
Well, I guess I'd like to finish up with my concerns about this trend, and particularly as it has regards to indigenous people. And that is there's what you can call a false causal association out there where because 1,000 years ago, let's say, whatever time and point you want to make before Columbus, there was an abundance of wildlife, Charles Mann being accepted, and seemingly intact rivers and so forth. You have to consider the low population and low technology, and that none of us, including indigenous people today, are without much greater ability. I mean, a tree that gets cut down with a chainsaw just because it's in the hands of an Indian is still being cut down. It doesn't matter who it is that's doing it. And we all have the ability to exploit the land and, you know, that's what humans do. That's what all animals do. So, I mean, in one sense, we're doing what is, you know, sort of we're programmed to do as creatures. On the other hand, we have to realize that with the population that we have in the globe today and the technology we have, we can do far more damage in a short amount of time than we could in the past. And you can't assume that anybody is exempt from the ability to have a significant influence. And that's why, you know, I prefer and think that things that are off limits for most resource extraction, like parks and wilderness, are the best option we have. And the other part about it, I might say, is that the creation of parks and wilderness is an act of humility and restraint, which would be a very good thing for all of us to have more of in our dealings with the natural world. And getting back to that earlier conversation we had about, you know, we just don't know enough to really fully appreciate what we're doing. And so my concern is we should be manipulating as little as possible to survive and have our a way to live here. And so that's where these areas are. They are sort of legally saying, well, this is a place that we're not going to do the normal things. And yes, it is sort of an artificial thing, you could say, in some ways, but it's also a necessary thing in some ways. Just like, you know, we all accept the idea that we have stoplights and so forth to regulate traffic on the roads, because if we didn't, we'd have lots more collisions and people getting hurt. So parks and wilderness and things like that are very much a necessity. We need more of them. We need a lot bigger ones, and we need a lot better protected ones, in my view. And which is why this idea of half Earth is a minimum I think we need to be shooting for as a goal.
Well, thank you for saying all that, and thank you for your constant defense of wild nature. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.